One of the biggest questions of our time is, who defines human identity? We hear this phrase, gender assigned at birth, as if a medical doctor or midwife determines someone's sex as soon as they leave their mother's womb. Now, can people transcend their biological sex? Is sex a cultural and societal construct, or is it something else? You're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters, and I'm your host, Richard Nelson, and we are going to tackle these questions with the help of John Stonestreet, president of the Colson Center. John is a sought-after speaker, author in the areas of faith, culture, and worldview. He's also the daily voice of Breakpoint, the national syndicated commentary on culture. John, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters program.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Hey, I think it's fair to say that there is alarm across our society, not just in the church, but by people outside the church. Moms and dads who have their kids in public schools, and they're concerned about what's being taught to them. Parents who have a daughter and girls in sports, and we just learned out of California the other week, a biological male won two of the categories, state champion in two track categories. Parents concerned about their middle school daughters in their private spaces. Just down the road from us, John, in Lexington, Kentucky, there was a middle school that was being built. And parents discovered in the blueprints that they were creating gender-neutral restrooms. So where do we even begin with this? How do we get to a place like this? I know that's a huge question. And I heard you speak at the Identity Project that the Colson Center hosted just a few weeks ago in Kentucky. But I think a good place to begin is when you have a major cultural shift, you have to have a major shift in opinion. Can you speak to that? What happened with public opinion? It used to, just 10 years ago, it was settled that male and female was determined by genetics, by biology. But something happened within the last 10 years. I think this is a good place for us to start.
Well, you know, you can go back and say what caused this and what caused this and what caused this. And pretty soon you're at the beginning of the world in a garden. But that is exactly the right question, because this came from somewhere, these ideas that were unthinkable yesterday that became unquestionable. Although I'm pleased that even in the decision issued by the U.S. Supreme Court this week in the Scrimeti case, we're starting to question something that was unquestionable just yesterday. And we're seeing, obviously, our European neighbors make hard calls and pull back on radical gender ideology, and especially the scenarios that you brought up, which is, you know, it's one thing when we're talking about these ideas about whether it's possible to be born in a wrong body or something like that, but it's another thing when we force those ideas on children and we give children radically interventionist and potentially irreversible treatments in the name of medicine, particularly now that we are starting to see a flood of detransitioners, people who thought they were born into the wrong body and have come into congruence with who they actually are. So where did this come from? No social revolution happens without ideas. And these ideas go way back, but let me give two of them that I think were particularly powerful that emerged out of what we often refer to as the sexual revolution. And then when you start applying them and seeing the implications and ramifications of them, the consequences go far and wide. The first one is that men and women are interchangeable. Now, this is an idea that was birthed out of feminist ideology, and early feminist ideology was exactly right, that men and women should have interchangeable rights, that, you know, there shouldn't be the case where women are left out of particular parts of society, not able to drive, not able to vote, not able to fully participate, just basically being the victims of men's whims and a lot of times bad behavior. But that transformed into men and women being interchangeable in roles. And certainly there were roles that women were being left out of in society. That was really important to correct those evils. But some roles are based in not just cultural norms, but they're actually based in reality. The differences that exist between men and women, it doesn't mean that those differences should imply inequality or should allow you know, men to overpower or oppress women. And so we needed to correct those role discrepancies kind of one by one. But somehow in the last 5 to 10, 15 years, an emerging set of ideas took that from being interchangeable in roles and rights to being interchangeable in reality, that any difference whatsoever was a sign of inequality, and that being male and female was nothing but a preference, nothing but a social construct. You know, it's one thing when you talk about gender components, things about how we express what it means to be male and female and recognize that that looks different in cultural time and place. But to say that that's not rooted in reality at all, that was the innovation, that who I truly am is my inner self. And that brings up the second idea. And that is that our dignity as human beings rests in our autonomy, that we should not be restricted by anybody's expectations. We should not be restricted by any laws to express our true selves. But even more, we shouldn't even be restricted by biological realities. And medicine then should serve not biological realities and bringing healing, but medicine should actually serve that autonomy so that we can do and be whoever we want to be, even if it means contradicting reality itself. And these are radical ideas that became mainstream in medicine and, as you pointed out, education.
John, I want to pick up on what I was hearing you say was that medicine has become politicized. No longer
that,
rooted in
that
science.
That is the simple way to say it right there. Yep.
We've been told for years, by the way, to believe the science, follow the science, particularly when it comes to global climate change. But the science does not support this idea that a biological woman can transcend her biology to become a man. Now, externally, she could undergo hormone treatments and surgical interventions to appear like a man, but at their core, they cannot become a male. Same with a man. So here's my question. As a public policy group here in Kentucky, we approach the issues from a principled perspective, a biblical worldview. We do believe in the science, by the way, and we have spoken on these issues and lobbied our legislators to believe the science, if you will. One of the biggest arguments against our side, your side, my side, is the medical associations, the American Medical Association, the American Pediatrics Association. They've endorsed this. How does that happen, John? The science doesn't support that, but these associations have supported something that is not good medicine. It's not rooted in science, and yet they've endorsed this, which is very confusing to many people. What's going on there?
It's been really confusing, and it's led to a catastrophic loss of trust, I think, between Americans and the medical system. And part of it goes back to that proclamation that is often said by activists, oftentimes without proof. And it was said in this case, which is the science is settled. You know, the science is settled. Scientists say, you know, the science hasn't been settled on this. It never was. What we now know because of leaked emails and so on from the self-proclaimed experts in this area, what's called WPATH, the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, these were all experts pointing to each other's expertise without the science, and then put a lot of social pressure on institutions to go along. And you know, Europe was about 5 or 10 years ahead of us on this. And what we have seen also in the last couple years is not only kind of revelations that WPATH was built on a house of sand, but also that these medical associations outside the U.S. backpedaled in a hurry. I mean, the most famous example being the Tavistock Clinic in the U.K. that performed many gender reassignment surgeries which I think is better called gender mutilation surgeries, interrupted puberty with hormones that have permanent impacts when the claim was, no, it just pauses. So we now know that what was called temporary is permanent. We now know that what was called treatment causes permanent alterations that people have to live with for the rest of their life. But we've always known that what makes us male and female is more than just outward appearance. It's chromosomes. You can't change chromosomes. It's reproductive organs and systems that we have. And you can remove those, but removing those causes harm. That's not a way to heal. And it's really a remarkable thing, but it tells you how quickly bad ideas can take root in society. And those ideas will have consequences, and bad ideas will always have victims. And I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that's happened is we have started to see an awful lot of regret. We know, for example, that there has been an incredible explosion of particularly young girls struggling and questioning who they are. Well, where did that come from? That happened in the last 5 years. The trans issue, when it emerged, was predominantly populated by men struggling with their identity and having a kind of sexual fetish that they were pursuing and chasing. And then all of a sudden, about 10 years ago, 5-1, according to whistleblowers in the UK and at St. Louis Hospital or Washington Hospital in St. Louis, it was teenage girls. And of course, they weren't trying to follow a sexual fetish. They were deeply struggling with who they were. And what happened was, to justify the adult desire, these children were rushed through, diagnosed. I mean, when you hear, for example, someone like Chloe Cole, who's one of the detransitioners who was pushed down this line, and you hear her story about how quickly she was told, this will help you. And it didn't help you. It didn't help her at all. And the harm that's been done is incalculable. So I think the ideology drove it, and the reality now is putting on the brakes.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. Have you found yourself frustrated and angry about the direction of the country? Maybe you're watching Fox News and you see what's happening in Congress or in other parts of the country. Let me encourage you to turn your frustration and energy into a positive direction. Have you considered running for local office? And listen to me for a minute. You can have a greater impact on local elections and on policy decisions if you serve in local government. School board, for example, they set curriculum decisions and tax policy. How about city council or fiscal court? These are very important elected offices where you can have a positive impact on. Consider running for local office. CPC is bringing candidate training events all across the state, and we'd love for you to join. If you've ever felt called to run or interested in running, come on and join us. You can find out more information at the Commonwealth Policy website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. Go ahead and check it out, and we hope to see you in the fall.
John, we have political leaders today who have not just waded into this issue, but they become champions of the LGB and the T cause. We have one here in Kentucky. Governor Andy Beshear spoke in the state capitol June the 1st to kick off Pride Month. And this is what he said in part. Kentucky and the rest of the United States cannot possibly reach its full potential unless our people feel supported to be themselves. Discrimination against our LGBTQ plus community is unacceptable. It holds us back. And in my Kentucky accent, it ain't right. Now, John, the political left has positioned LGBTQ identity as one of human rights, where if you don't agree with somebody's self-identified sexual identity to be themselves, you must be homophobic or transphobic or hate them. You're not supportive of them. You're against them. How do we address that? Where do we start with that?
You know, it's such a great question. And, you know, I'm not specifically in the political space like you are, but I do think we have the scientific case now. It is crystal clear. And we saw that collision even in the Supreme Court decision that came out this week in the Scrimeti case, where Clarence Thomas, in his concurring opinion, just articulated on each of these medical interventions puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgical interventions, just the real harm that's done. And on the other hand, you had Justice Sotomayor write a dissent. And she claimed things in her dissent that are not where the science and medicine are. It was almost as if she weren't sitting there listening to the oral arguments like everyone else was. Now, listen, are there medical professionals who disagree? Yeah, there are. But you know what? It's not anywhere close to being able to say, here's what we now know. Second, I think we need to highlight and push forward and tell the stories as much as is possible of the harm that's been done to children, particularly when state officials embrace this ideology over and above the rights of parents. When school officials smuggle this into the classroom, and we know when it happens because they don't want parents to know. There is a case pending in Michigan, out of Michigan right now, in which a school district in a pretty conservative part of the state basically took a young girl and who was autistic. And by the way, I'll get to that in just a second about the medical comorbidities that go along with this. But they basically gave her a new name, called her by different pronouns. And then when communication went home to the parents, they went back to the original name and original pronouns. In other words, they intentionally deceived the parents by what was happening in the classroom, as if the state knows better than parents do. And if the state cares more about children than parents do, it's horrific. It's a horrific sort of thing to happen. And it sets a precedent that says that kids belong to the state. And the other thing is, look at the science, particularly on psychological comorbidities or medical comorbidities of those who identify as having gender dysphoria or struggling with who they are. There's an incredible number of children, for example, that have been diagnosed with autism and are somewhere on the autism spectrum who also identify identify as having a struggle with who they are. Some sort of psychological distress, depression, and so on. And you know, the other thing is, they're online. They're on social media. We know that social media has not been good for our children. We know that dramatic amounts of time spent during COVID at home in front of screens left them vulnerable to predators, either sexual predators online or ideological predators using these ideas to make young people question who they are. And listen, it's to see the incredible spike, especially of young women. This is an anomaly. Something happened 10 years ago, and we need to ask what it was, because to say that somehow the world was ignorant of this for its entire existence, and then suddenly people are raising up, being, as the governor says, who they truly are, the facts do not support this at any level.
John, just to add to what you're saying about that Michigan case, we had a situation not far from the Commonwealth Policy Center office where there was a high school girl, a junior, who was coached to into her lesbian identity. That's what she said, that she was in a relationship. This high school counselor kept it hidden from the parents. This counselor was communicating privately with the student. And this was found out. The parents recovered the text messages and were appalled at what was going on. It was a Christian family, confused daughter, struggling daughter. But you had a school, public school official, personnel, leading them in a different direction. Now, fortunately, in Kentucky, we have a conservative state legislature, and they enacted a bill this last session that restricts that kind of communication. They have to go through another communication avenue that can be discovered from anybody that looks into the communications between a teacher or guidance counselor and the students. We've also got a legislature here, John, that has preserved women's sports. They've kept biological boys off the girls' sports teams. They have prohibited the teaching of gender ideology in the schools. They have also banned gender transitions, sex transitions of minors. So we've seen a lot of positive steps to protect our children. And you brought up the Scrimeti decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this week. And tell us what some of your thoughts are. Of course, we know that that law protects states like Kentucky that have pushed back against the gender ideology complex, if you will, promoting this to our young people in particular. Could you add to some other, how will we look at this Supreme Court case, Scrimeti, just, you know, down the line, is this a watershed case? Is this something that we'll point to and say, okay, here's where the tide has turned in this push of gender ideology, for lack of a better term, nonsense? Is this a watershed case?
Yeah. Well, first, let me say, as a resident of Colorado, I'm jealous of all the things that you've been able to do. We're in a different pool out here in Colorado. Let's just put it that way. The Scrimeti decision will be part of this watershed moment, and what I mean is we have lots of indicators over the last year and a half that the train that seemed to be runaway and unstoppable in this area has been turned around, or has at least been dramatically slowed down. And for the Supreme Court to allow the legislature of various states to make these decisions on the ground is really, really important. Now, let's be really clear. The Scrimeti case did not issue a ban on transgender, quote unquote, medical treatments, which I think is, by the way, it's an anomaly. That's not the right word for that. For minors, states can still do very much, pro work in that area. But it allows states like Kentucky and others to hold on to their law, saying this is not going to happen in our state. It is the number one responsibility of a state legislature to protect its citizens, especially the future citizens, its children, and that's what Kentucky and other states have done. Now, the reason this is going to be consequential, I think, is in two reasons. Number one is by allowing states to make those decisions. And let's be really clear, it did so on a kind of a technicality, Justice Roberts' majority opinion, but not an insignificant technicality. Basically, the Supreme Court has ruled that certain state laws have to pass heightened scrutiny when it has to do with sex discrimination. This, you know, goes back to the 14th Amendment and other things. The question was this particular ban on quote-unquote transgender treatments, does it fit under the category of sex? And you might remember a couple years ago, Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion in the Bostock case, which had to do with employment law, and basically said that trans stuff equals sex discrimination. It was a terrible decision, honestly, and it was unjustifiable, but that's what those who were suing this law were trying to smuggle in, the findings of Bostock, into this case on medical treatment of minors. What the court decided in the majority opinion, 6-3, was that this did not qualify for sex discrimination. It qualifies for age discrimination and medical discrimination. In other words, we're talking specifically about banning treatment for minors. And number two, we're talking about whether a set of medications and treatments that are legitimate in certain medical cases should be used off-brand in order to treat this psychological. And this is not something that the medical establishment has decided or the FDA actually ever considered, you know, in the case of puberty blockers and so on. And so medical discrimination and age discrimination in these decisions are not the same as sex discrimination, and that's what they did. Now, Justice Alito and Justice Roberts, sorry, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, it's hard to keep all these guys straight. Justice Alito and Justice Thomas wrote concurring opinions where they essentially invited further consideration, both in challenging states like Colorado, who are trying to force this on citizens, challenging, you know, basically the state parent distinction, challenging the implications of the Bostock decision, and challenging really the harms that this stuff does. I mean, Thomas's concurring opinion was a force. So when you say, is this a watershed moment? It's part of a watershed moment. And if all of these concurring opinions lead to further cases that challenge, the stranglehold that this has had on medicine and on education, then yes, we're going to see that it's a stranglehold, we're going to see that it's a watershed moment. And I think that's what's going to happen. So I think it will be.
John, we're running out of time, but I want us to land, first of all, commend you and the Colson Center for leading with the Identity Project. Well done conference that you held in Louisville recently. It's a much needed conference, bringing perspectives in to help teachers, pastors, parents understand this whole idea of identity. But I want us to land on this, the idea of Christian identity. Where do we understand who we are? And we got just a brief amount of time. What does it mean to be human and to be made in the image of God? And I want you to close us out on
that. 30 seconds or less.
Yeah. Listen, that's a whole nother program, right?
listen, all of these legal concerns and political concerns are downstream from upstream cultural concerns. And a fundamental one is, what does it mean to be human? Who are we? And are we really whoever we want to be? Do we simply follow our hearts, or is our identity given to us by God? And it's good. And that's what I think is so important here, is that we are dealing with a legitimate identity crisis across the West, and we have specific implications for America and for America's children. And the Christian understanding is that God created us in His image, and He created us male and female, and that includes body, soul, spirit. That includes who we are as individuals and who we are in the context of our larger relationships. And this is not only a good idea, it's better than all the others that are out there about having to self-construct and self-create and our bodies misaligning and all that, but it's the true idea. It aligns with reality, what we know. And now we can follow the medicine and show that there is this alignment between who we are, quote unquote, inside and who we are on the outside. And that we can actually help with that. And that ultimately Jesus Christ came to restore who we truly are in our relationship with God. And once all those relationships are realigned, then we can be at peace and confidence with our true identity. That's what the Identity Project, which folks can find at identityproject.tv. It's a whole set of video resources that walk through both the theological and the biblical, but also the scientific, medical, the social, the educational implications of this understanding of human identity.
Very good. That's identityproject.tv. John Stonestreet, what a good word to end on. Thank you so much for joining us, and God bless you. Keep up the good work.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be with you. Thanks for your good work as well.